It's a nice new feeling to have people close by. Okay. Anyway, right. Okay. This is a lecture where I'm going to throw a lot of terminology at you, which is one of the reasons why I would like to have you a little bit closer, and I would like those who are here to be able to have, to pay full attention. Okay. Before I talk about what I want to do this week, I'd like to quickly introduce something which you will be seeing again and again throughout this lecture course. I call it, this is a bit of a funny name, it's not a name that British lecturer would use. British lecturers would use, the no list. Okay? The no list is a list of concepts that I will give you, that I will upload finally after the end of the course also as a PDF, which includes those terms that you absolutely need to know in order to be able to, for example, do the exam. Okay? So, for example, it looks like this. It says human and animal communication, which is what we did last time, and then you have a number of terms on it. And those terms, in fact, all of them, almost, are in boldface. This means that they are essential. You need to be able to know, not only you don't need to just know them, but you actually need to be able to use them to explain what they are to your colleagues. You need to be able to apply those terms in the right context. Okay. If it's not boldface, then this is something which I expect you to have an idea of, but I wouldn't consider them to be absolutely essential for answering the question. It doesn't mean that you can rely on the fact that nothing on onomatopoeia is going to turn up in the exam. But it isn't going to be essential in the sense that if you don't know the term fully, you're going to fail or something like that. Okay, so it's something which I would recommend that you look at, which you sort of know, but not to the extent of the other bold-faced ones. And then there are other terms in brackets, particularly under spelling, where I've already, I think, indicated it last time. I did that last time. Where I said that spelling is, what I'm going to say is a bit of a preparation for what we're going to do today. Yeah? Did you go to last week's lecture? Anyone not know what onomatopoeia means? Okay, just a few. Can someone answer what onomatopoeia? Yeah? Yeah. Okay, Lautmalerei in German. I introduced the fact that language is arbitrary, okay, that we have arbitrary signs, and there is no connection between the meaning of a word, for example, and the way it looks, whether we say chair or whether we say Stuhl or whatever is a convention that we have formed among the speakers of the same language, but there is no immediate correlation between meaning and form. This is different with onomatopoeic words, for example, snore, some people think, where the sound of the word is actually a bit of an image of what's happening when you snore. Okay. Right, so that's this. Then a few important concepts, all of which are not bold-faced concepts, but important to know. And then everything under spelling is sort of nice to have, which is why they're in brackets. So all of those that are in brackets are the kind of things that if you know them and can actively use those terms, then that's probably the difference between a 1 and a 2. But there is no need to know all of them in depth for the final exam if you don't want a 1. Okay, but if you want a 1, then that would probably be good. Okay, so I'm going to always upload those, or actually put them on the slides probably, but in any case they will be found online on StudIP as well. So these are the terms that are intended to help you prepare for the exam, the dreaded exam, okay? Which I'm sure by now you've heard a few things about. One important point in this connection, I am not primarily interested in a definition of duality, for example. I will not ask a question or I plan or hope not to ask a question where I'm just asking for a definition. What is duality? But you are much more likely to get a question from me which is going to give you the opportunity to show that you've understood the concept. So, for example, one past question was, evaluate the claim that human and animal communication are in fact very similar. Which is really quite close to what we've done in the lecture. So I don't think it's a nasty question. Which would then allow you to bring in the terms and give examples, etc., and you would then be able to show how similar or perhaps how not so similar the two types of communication are using the terminology we introduced in this course. Okay? So you get quite a few of those lists for each topic, for each sort of set of lectures, you'll get one. Okay? If anything is not clear on those lists, please send me an email. Right. Talking about the exam, there was a retake of the exam at the beginning of October, which some of you I know have taken. You're now listening to the lecture again, or you're redoing the lecture again. Those of you who've done it and would like to look at it, there will be an opportunity to look at all three parts if you've taken all three, literature, linguistics, and TESOL, on the Tuesday next week. Okay. From 4 to 5:30 in my office, B344. If you can't make that, get in contact with me, get in touch with me, you'll find a different date. You can also come to my normal office hours on Wednesday morning. I'm sure we'll all find a way. It's not that many people. We'll find a way for you to look at the exams. Okay? Right. A last bit of organizational matter. We've got something, those of you who've looked at the schedule saw that there is something it says assignment next week, right? Now, this was originally planned to be the deadline for a library assignment, which I'm going to ask you to do. Given that I'm now in contact with the people from the library to see whether you get additional introductory tours, I might put it off by a couple of weeks. Alternatively, I might actually set it by next Friday. I'm still making up my mind whether I want to do this or not. But in any case, you don't have to worry about an assignment that needs to be handed in by next Friday. That's not true. So just sit back and relax and, enjoy today's lecture, which is the first of two lectures. This is where we're now really starting with some of the nitty-gritty of one level of linguistic description. Okay. Are there any other questions first? I hear some commotion. Is anything in terms of organizational matters not clear? No. Okay, good. So, we are now going to, or I'm going to tell you a lot about the sounds of English. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a slight overlap with what you might hear in some of the language courses. I know that some of you have already seen, for example, something I'm going to show you later, namely the IPA chart, which is a chart where all the sounds of English and, in fact, the sounds of other languages are found on and which we will use to describe sounds. I know that you've seen this, but you haven't actually looked very much into what it means that one sound is there and one sound is on a different part of that chart. So we'll look at it in much more detail. Okay. I also I'll say that in a minute. So we're going to look at the sounds of English, and we're also going to look at how it is possible to devise some kind of, let's call it a writing system, to transcribe the sounds. I'm sure all of you have been in some way exposed to transcriptions. If you look at most dictionaries today, then you'll see transcriptions of how a word should be pronounced. The problem with those transcriptions is that that a number of different systems exist. Okay? In fact, the reading, which is part of the preparation or post-preparation, or I don't know what to call that, after lecture reading. For this lecture today and the one next week, the reading in Finnegan, in fact, also uses a slightly different system. Now, this is something which I know you don't like. I know you don't like to have different ways of calling the same thing. Unfortunately, in linguistics, this happens very often. In fact, there are different approaches to quite a few things in linguistics. I know this is confusing, but I've decided not to follow the transcription system in Finnegan, but I'd rather use the one that is internationally acknowledged and used by linguists, by researchers worldwide, rather than the American textbook style that Finnegan uses. Yeah. So, but in fact, I think it also helps if you see the difference and if you understand what's different, then you can actually make sense of why it is different, and that helps you understand what's going on. Okay? So, as I said, I'm going to throw quite a lot of terminology at you. You don't have to learn all of that terminology by heart by next week, but you will at some stage have to learn all those words that I'm going to introduce you to. So I would very strongly recommend doing that rather early, or sort of not leaving it to the end. Okay, that was the beginning. What is speech? Well, here's a short quote for you. No, wait a minute. That should have been a short quote. Here it is. Okay. The most highly skilled muscular activity that human beings ever achieve. Okay. Which already tells you that the muscles are somehow involved in this, and we'll have to see how that actually works. Okay. So it's something, obviously, that we do somewhere here, inside, with the mouth. And depending on how we move or have certain parts of the mouth touch each other, different sounds come out of our mouths. Okay. Before we look at this, a brief excursion to what is sound in the first place. But it's really a form of energy. Okay. And I'm sure all of you have done this when you did physics. You know that air particles vibrate, and they then sort of, these particles nudge the air particles next to them, and thereby sound is transmitted, in fact, in waves. Okay? And you know the term sound waves. Okay? What then happens is actually quite an ingenious invention. We've got the eardrum picking up those waves and somehow translating them in our brain into something that we can then make sense of. And that is a fairly advanced cognitive process, as you can perhaps imagine, because all it is really is particles that vibrate, but we use it for one of the most fundamental ways of interacting, namely by communication as humans. Now, we do this because the different sounds are, of course, perceived differently depending on how the vibration takes place, whether it's vibrating very quickly or whether it's, for example, not such a, well, whether it's a lower frequency vibration. And I think you know everyone's done the bottle experiment. Okay? Notice that I said bottle experiment. I could also have said the bottle experiment. Yeah? We'll come back to that later towards the end of the lecture. We know that something which is a sort of, yeah, for example, a bottle, but not only a bottle, will have the shape of that, will have an influence on the kind of sound that is produced. If it's a larger shape, if there's more air inside in the bottle, then it'll be a deeper sound, etc. Yes, that's why I wanted to mention the bottle experiment. When you go to the dentist, then, of course, the dentist will ask you to say E or ah. Well, it will probably be ah, of course. Please say ah. Why? Well, because you open your mouth. Now, if you do not open your mouth and you say E, then that obviously isn't so good for the dentist. But it also very clearly produces a different sound. You can try this out yourself. Can you say ah with a closed mouth, or can you say ee with something with your chin all the way down. You're welcome to try this out now. You can do it. For the next few minutes, you'll be feeling rather embarrassed to do this. That's fine. Everyone can do it. So there seems to be... Ah, you got it. Okay. Right. There seems to be a connection between what we do with the thing around our chin and the things that are inside our mouth and the sound that comes out of it. Okay. If we lower our lips, if we open our mouth, if we have a larger cavity, so to speak, the sound that we produce is, for example, ah. Okay. And if we close it, and if our tongue is higher up, then we produce e. Okay. Now this has got to do, or this brings me to basically looking at the human vocal tract, because that's basically where it's decided what's going on or what's coming out of our mouth. Okay. This is what a human looks like when you cut it in half, the head. Okay. And this may now sound very primitive because most of those terms you already know, but it's important to listen because each of them has an important impact on the sounds that we produce when we speak English or in fact any other language. Yes, of course, the lips. Yes. We've got the lips moving up and down, but of course only the lower one. This is trivial, but I mean you can't really move the... No, it doesn't work. Yeah? You move. As always, you're welcome to try this out yourself. Okay. The upper lip is non-mobile. Okay. Then we've got the teeth. And again, you will not be surprised to hear that the upper teeth are non-mobile. Yeah? And in fact, yes. Theoretically, it would be possible to use all the teeth to produce sounds. You can sort of think of, I don't know, moving your tongue to the back somehow and then touching teeth and that making a different sound. Like, don't try that out now. But yeah. So only the front teeth are used in speech production. Right. Lips and teeth you knew. Alveolar ridge you probably didn't know as a term. Okay. The alveolar ridge is the thing if you try putting your tongue just behind the teeth and then move it slightly back, then you get some kind of bumpy feeling. That's the alveolar ridge. Okay. And there are sounds that we produce, we'll come to that in a minute, by putting our tongue in contact with the alveolar ridge. Okay. The next one is the hard palate, which is when you move the tongue back a little bit further. It's this sort of round, curvy thing on top of your mouth cavity. Okay. And then if you move your... Yes, you can still do that. Tongue a little bit further, then you get to a point where it becomes soft. Okay. And that's the velum, which is a soft tissue. Okay. Some people call it the soft palate. Yes, I can hear some people making... Yes, you can still move your tongue there. Okay. Good. Then you've got the uvula, okay, which is, again, perhaps a term that you've heard before. It's some kind of pendulum. It's the little thing in the back when you open your mouth and look in the mirror that sort of hangs down. Okay. Yeah. It stops bits of food going up the nose when you swallow. So it's quite important for that purpose. It isn't very important for English. Okay. Right. Then we have what's commonly referred to as the throat. The throat, phoneticians don't call it the throat. They like fancy terms. Okay. They call it the pharynx. Okay. And the top of the pharynx, I'm just basically reading off here, but this is a summary already. That splits into, the oral cavity or the nasal cavity. So we've got two cavities on top of each other, like little caves, so to speak, therefore cavity. And we've got the one which ends in the nose and the other one which, where the mouth is. And in fact, the velum acts, as you can see here, as some kind of valve. Okay. It decides whether the air moves into the nose or not. If it is lower, then it can enter into the nose, and if it's raised, then the air must, if we breathe, automatically go through our mouth. Okay. Right, so that's the pharynx. It's okay. And then we've got another word ending in I, in Y and X. So and that's the larynx. That's this bit down here between where the food goes down into your stomach, and this is the bit which is very important for speech production. I'll come to that in a minute. And the front of the larynx is often protruded. Okay. Now, if you're male, then you can probably feel this here. If you're female, then much less so. Okay. In fact, there are men with a rather protruding larynx, also called Adam's apple. Okay. Good. And then we've got something, as I've already said, that, very, very important, the vocal folds. Stimmbänder in German. Also called vocal cords. And they can open and close, and depending on what they do, while the size between them is bigger or smaller, and this size between them is actually called the glottis. So, you've got quite a few new terms now. Glottis, larynx, uvula, velum, alveolar rich, palate, soft palate. I guess lips and teeth were fine. Okay, but that's... Yeah. Oh yes, and the tongue, of course. The tongue being extremely important, which has sort of this shape, and which is a very movable or flexible piece of equipment in our mouth. Okay. We'll come to that. The tongue is separated into several parts. This is, again, in a way trivial. The tip, the front, the center, and the back. And in fact, further back, you've got the root. Now, all of these elements that I've now introduced, which is actually quite a lot, virtually all contribute in some way or other to the kinds of sounds that we produce when we speak, both in English and in German, and of course in all other languages. Good. As I said, they cooperate. Okay. But we need something which is absolutely essential, and that's air. Okay. And in fact, the fancy term for this is pulmonic airstream. Okay. Why pulmonic? Because it originates from the lungs. Okay. And if you've got pulmonia, then you have a problem with your lungs. So. In fact, here's another term. This would now be a term that I wouldn't really expect you to actively apply. In fact, it's egressive. Okay. What does that mean? Well, basically the air comes out when we produce sounds. There are languages where sort of ingressive airstream is used to produce sounds as part of the language, but this is not the case for English. Right, so we've got those different spaces, different places where that are involved. And then I already introduced the concept of the glottis and the vocal cords that vibrate, and they produce what's known as voicing. Okay. And it depends on, as I said, the size of the glottis. This is again now something where you can try things out yourself. If it is open, then we don't have any kind of interruption of the airstream, even if it's only something slight. There is no vibration taking place. If it's if the space between the vocal cords is narrow, then the air causes the vocal cords to vibrate, and this vibration creates sound. Try this yourself if you want. When you say the first sounds in those words, see, she, and fee, and you put your hand onto your throat, then you will not really feel any vibration. If you then say, okay, then you will have felt a distinct difference. Okay. I know this is very simple and primitive, but it really is, well, the difference between voice and voiceless sounds. Okay. So, quite obviously the first sounds in the words see, she, and fee are voiceless, but in fact there might be variants, or there may be other words, in fact, where sounds that are produced in the same way are used, but the only difference is that the voicing is there. Then we also have a concept which is not so important for English, but I wanted to mention it anyway. We have, of course, the concept of pitch, in the sense that we have higher and lower sounds. This has got to do with, again, it's like the bottle experiment. We've got larger cavities rather than smaller cavities in male setups. So that's why men tend to have lower voices than women. By the way, again, something if you want to try out. Can you hum a tune and whisper at the same time? Of course not, because whispering, by definition, is voiceless, and humming a tune relies on voicing. Good. Those were the basics, in the sense that we now have a whole set of positions that seem to be involved, places inside our mouth, and now we need to look at how English consonants are actually produced. Now, I thought I'd show you a little video. And in fact, I'm going to lower the... I'm actually almost going to switch it off, or probably I'm going to switch it off, because this is something that you can see much better when it's dark. I'll switch it on again later. Don't worry. So, next week. Ah, this is already... okay. Yeah. Okay. So quite clearly, I've got a second one, so I'm not switching on the light yet. Quite clearly, the tongue moves. We also see the front parts of our mouth being involved. And the tongue was highest when on top of his deck, when the k sound was produced.
The pa, the ta, the ka, the pa, the ta, the ka, the pa, the ta, the ka, the pa, the ta.
Now these were actually X-ray videos, as far as I know. Probably wouldn't be done anymore today. These were from 50s, if I'm not mistaken, but fairly old. Unfortunately, the link doesn't exist anymore where they were shown. There were a few others, but you might still find it if you go to archive.org, which is an archive of the internet. It was a course in phonetics by a famous phonetician, Peter Ladefoged. Okay. Right, so after the fun, now we need to look at the actual detail. We have place and manner of articulation as two important aspects of producing a sound. We will actually start with the consonants and then finish off with the vowels. We have this example here. Hapa, hata, haka. Okay. Now you can imagine that if I change something, anything in the setup here, something else might be produced. For example, hafa hesa and hecha or something like that. I'm not saying that they exist in English, but just to get the principle across. What we've done is we've changed the p with some kind of small explosion, so to speak, to something where the air stream egresses, comes out of your mouth constantly. Yeah. And we've done this without voicing. If we add voicing, we get hba, hda, hga, okay, or hva, hza, and I don't know, hra, or something like that. And there you can see one important point that I wanted to make. The English spelling system doesn't cover all the sounds that exist, not even all the sounds that exist in English. And that's why the spelling, as we saw last time, this is one of the reasons why the spelling is different from the sound that we produce. Not well different. There is no one-to-one correspondence. There are languages, Italian for example, where there is much closer correspondence. Okay. The way this is done is, as I've said before, or the way this is organized, or the way this is best captured in, is the International Phonetic Alphabet, the IPA. It's a system of phonetic notation. In fact, it is, to help people, based on the Latin alphabet. It's got a more than 100-year-old history. It keeps being revised. The last revision, as far as I'm aware, I am myself not a phonetician, this is not my area of expertise, is the last revision is about 6 years back. Okay. If you want to find out more about the IPA, the International Phonetic Association also, then this is the link where you can go. Okay, let's start with the consonants. Different places of articulation. We could have bilabial consonants. For example, as in pop. Or we can have labiodental. Well, you can sort of see what happens. Labio is lip, dental is tooth. Both lips and tooth are involved. Therefore, it's labiodental. Fish, the lower lip, touches the upper teeth, and that's how it is produced. Yes, you can produce this yourself now if you want. Dental, or sometimes called interdental, okay, where the sort of the blade of the tongue, the tip of the tongue, is sort of near the front teeth, obviously the front teeth. Yeah. This is called dental, or sometimes interdental. And that's the sound which is very important for English. It's the sound, okay, which is realized in writing as TH. Okay, but it's not as if this is sort of, well, it's the writing part of it. It's the spelling system part of it. But we're really only talking about one sound, even though we've got two letters, a digraph, so to speak. And that's when we put the tongue between the teeth, so to speak. Then we've got an alveolar place of articulation. So the tip of the tongue is near the alveolar ridge, as it was when you were trying out where it is. And that's important for, or that's where we would produce sounds like t or s. Okay? So top and c. So you can see what happens when you have ba on top, then you basically move the mouth, move the tongue from between the teeth back up to the alveolar ridge, and that's where the different sound is produced. Okay, that were the first four. Then moving back a little bit further, we've got post-alveolar, and here actually you will find in the literature quite a few different ways of referring to this: alveopalatal, palato-alveolar. I use post-alveolar, but you're free to choose whatever you like. Okay. Ship, the sh as in ship, which is further back than s. Okay. Palatal, the yes, okay, where the tongue touches or almost touches a little bit further back. So the y as in yes. Wheeler, that's the one that we saw as the third sound where we had hepa, hepta, hepka, so k as in kiss. And then we've got a glottal sound as well, as in house. So the position where this sort of slight fracture takes place is in the glottis. That was place of articulation. And in fact, although these are good examples of places of articulation or of the different places of articulation, they are not all produced in the same manner of articulation. When we talk about manner of articulation, we talk about how much obstruction there is, how much the air, or in what way the air that egresses from the lungs is interrupted, either fully interrupted or partially interrupted or just not interrupted at all. You can, for example, imagine if I say something like ah, then there is no interruption. Okay, that's a vowel, we're now doing consonants, but still. Some people call it stricture, okay, the obstruction. And we could have full stricture, which means that for a period of time, maybe a very short period of time, we have a complete blockage of the airstream. Or we could have only part of the airstream being, well, almost like squeezed through. Well, not part of the airstream, the whole airstream needs to squeeze through. That's what some people call close approximation. Or we could have no stricture, as in open approximation. Okay, let's have a look at the different manners and then link this up with the different places. We have plosives. Okay. Easy to remember, I think. Explosion, plosion, plosive. You could also call them stop, and I think that is also easy to see, because the air actually for a very short period of time stops completely, is interrupted completely. So the air is trapped in your mouth, there's some kind of extra pressure involved, and then it's forcefully released. Okay. And that's where the explosion comes from, but it's not explosion, it's just plosion. Okay. We can have bilabial plosives, b, or alveolar plosives, t, d, or velar plosives, k, g. And in fact, we also have a glottal plosive. This is something which happens in many languages, which happens in English, for example, in words like butter. Well, not butter, because what I use there is I use an alveolar plosive. But I can also say, in certain parts of England, also in certain dialects of England, and nowadays increasingly in Estuary English, which is becoming sort of the new standard of pronunciation, I can say butter. Butter. I lived in England for 3 years. My son grew up in England the first few years, from the time he was about 2 years old. And after about 2 years in England, he was talking about his water bottle. Water bottle. Yeah? A water bottle. Yeah. What bottle? Yeah, I can't. Yeah. So, we've got three glottal stops in there. Notice that the glottal stop is always voiceless. Okay. Good, that were the plosives. Now the affricates. We also have some kind of plosive part in this. Okay. We also have complete stricture, complete obstruction. Yeah. So in that sense they are similar, but the release is not of the same type, where sort of the airstream suddenly gets through. But it's a slower sort of period of increased friction which we have. So, for example, church. When you try this out yourself, then you can see that there is a plosive involved. It's completely cut off. But then we sort of slower way than when we say t, we then leave out the air. Church. You can try it out if you want. Or judge. So the j. Okay, those were the affricates. Fricatives. Next one is the fricatives. We're basically now moving from full closure, from complete obstruction, to open. Here again we've got partial stricture, but we've got partial stricture from the outset. There is no plosive involved at all. Again, you can do this in various places of your mouth. And I'm only doing the English sounds now. You could have a labiodental fricative, leaf, or leave, v, the voiced version of it. You can have the dental fricative that I've already introduced, okay. Both, of course, in the voiced and the voiceless version. You can do this further back with the tongue on the alveolar ridge, C or ZU. You can do this in post-alveolar position, wash, measure. And you have a glottal fricative as well, house. Okay. Good. We're almost there. Approximants. They are made with so-called open approximation, so the airstream can basically get through very easily. So the place between the so-called articulators are those elements that are involved in the production, is very wide, and therefore we have no stricture. Okay. If you produce the R sound, the alveolar, the red, okay, then that's the alveolar ridges involved there. Okay. Or the palatal approximant, as in yes, or the labiovelar, as in wet. Now, why is this labial velar? Why is it not just labial? Because if you produce this sound, we've got wet. Okay, we clearly do something with our lips, but in a way, two things are involved: not just the lips, but we actually go back and do something in the back of our mouth as well with the velum. And in fact, some people call this double articulation. Okay. So, in that sense, it's open approximation, but two parts are involved. Okay. Lateral is another one. These are minor ones, but still, I would like to list them. Lateral, as in loud. What's special about this? You've got the tongue touching the alveolar ridge, but sort of the sides of the tongue are lowered so that the air can flow through. Yes, and I've got the glottal fricative here again, which I shouldn't have put there. This is a copy-paste error. Scratch that. It's not. Sorry, I'll remove it before I upload it, I hope. Okay, and then we've got nasals. Now we're really almost there. Nasals are produced when we stop the airflow through the mouth completely, and all the air comes out through the nose. Because the velum is lowered, okay, this sort of flexible thing in the back of your mouth, because muscles pull on it, gets lowered. Okay, the muscles pull on it, so that's why this happens, and that's also why I gave you this quote at the beginning. The muscles are really the muscular activity is really quite sophisticated. We've got a bilabial nasal. We've got an alveolar nasal, as in neat. And we've got a velar nasal, as in sing. Okay. Notice that they're all voiced. Okay, a few more manners, just briefly. You may have heard of the tap. This is something like a stop, but it's really only for a fraction of the time. This is something that the Americans, for example, do, as in city, very, very quickly. or muddy. Okay. Alveolar tract. This is the important one for Americans, so I'll leave this as the only tap. We also have trills, which are in fact nothing but a very quick succession of taps. Okay. So the rolled which is not part of standard RP pronunciation, but which might exist in some dialects, is an alveolar trill. Okay, we're there with the consonants. We've now covered all the consonants relevant for English, but only the consonants relevant for English. There are quite a few others, and you can have a look at the chart which I've already uploaded to StudIP, and you'll see that there are quite a few other options. But these options have in common that you can describe them by using the articulators involved and the manner of articulation. Okay. This is the IPA chart for consonants. And you can see these are the labial ones, the labiodental ones, the dental ones, the alveolar ones, etc. Yeah. While here we've got plosive, nasal, trill, tap, fricative, lateral fricative, etc. So you can see how you can describe sounds on the basis of place and manner, and in fact you will see that within one cell you've sometimes got two. Well, the first one is always the voiceless one, and the second one is the voiced one. Hmm? Do you know this symbol? Notice it says joke alert up here. There are not that many linguists jokes around, but this is one. In fact, this is a phonetician's joke. There are also a few of those. This is the nasal ingressive voiceless velar trill. Can someone do that for me? Yep. Yeah. I leave it up to you to see the yes. Yeah, okay. No, this is not an IPA chart symbol. There are people who actually try to actively get it into the IPA, but they have so far not been able to convince the International Phonetic Association. You can buy a T-shirt like this. Okay. I am a trained linguist. Don't try to do this at home. Anyway, so that was the consonants. Oh, yes. Yeah. No. The ones that I've mentioned now are really the relevant ones for English. Okay. I'm always a bit careful saying no in such a decisive manner because if you look at the different dialects of English, then you might actually find quite a few things. And I'll give you an example later on where you actually have a sound in English, in a dialect of English, that doesn't usually exist in English, but note this one, I'm quite certain. Right, vowels. Okay, now we go through all the vowels. We need a different terminology here because the air is always, it's always produced with open approximation. It's always, the airflow is not interrupted. Okay. Also, obviously, by definition, vowels are always voiced. You can't have a voiceless vowel. Yeah, makes sense. So what people instead do is they talk about something that's called the vowel space. So where in the mouth is the vowel produced, so to speak? You can find this out yourself, what happens when you produce the vowels found in seat, set, and sat in succession. I-A-A. Try this out yourself. E-A-A. Okay. Do the same for the vowels in seat, soup. E-U. E-U. Okay. Without rounding your lips, which isn't so easy. Now, those of you who were brave enough to do this will have felt, no doubt, that your tongue moves, and that it's mainly your tongue that moves. E-U. E-U. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. Now, obviously, also the lips are involved, because I said that they can be rounded, okay? But the most important bit at the moment is the position of the tongue. Okay. And this can be shown in something which is known as the vowel trapezium. Now, this is something, if you consider this as sort of the space where this all happens, particularly that bit up here, then you can sort of see that this is the front, this is the back, this is higher up, this is lower. So if you think of a sound that is produced like ah, then this bit moves lower. So if you think of this as a schema, then you can probably see how this fits into something like that. Okay. And you have the front of the mouth and the top. Okay. So you've got the front, and you've got central part, and you've got the back part. And, well, front and top isn't really what we use here, closed, because the mouth is closed when we say something like E. E, which is a front vowel, which is produced in a closed position. Opposite, obviously, being open. And then there are gradations in between, closed mid and open mid. And this is basically done by moving the tongue into different positions. And the positions are gradable, or they are on sort of a vertical movement, in a vertical movement, or different vertical positions, and different horizontal positions. And in fact also whether, while we produce the sound, the tongue moves or not. Finally, we've got the lips that are rounded. Okay. In fact, we've also got short and long vowels, but they are not meaning distinguishing in English anymore. So, and if we do this, then we can put all the vowels that exist in English into this vowel trapezium. And we have the different symbols for the vowels so that we can transcribe those sounds when they happen in English sounds. Now, I'd like to not go through all of them now in any greater detail, at least not here, but you can, for example, see that front and high, or front close, as I introduced before, this is the sound as in E. And in fact, E with two dots means it's long, so it's fleece. So this is what's called the fleece vowel. No, you do not need to know all the names for the vowels by heart. Okay. You need to know where they're produced and what sounds they are. But whether it's the fleece vowel or the, I don't know, another word with E, long E vowel, I don't really mind. Okay. We've got the difference between kit and fleece, and you can try this out yourself. The tongue moves slightly lower and further to the back, just a little bit. Yeah. We've got cat. In fact, we've got cat twice here. Why do we have that twice? Well, because one of them is actually the way the RP, which is, well, the received pronunciation, the standard pronunciation that hardly anyone speaks anymore, would produce, and then the more likely one today in Estuary English and others, cat. 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 Okay. This one is funny. How is this produced? Or what does it mean? It means E. Face. Is this the way you produce the sound E in face? You say face? Well, you say face. I can hardly do this, but you say face if you, for example, live in the northwest of England. They have this vowel which doesn't exist in standard RP. In fact, they also have this vowel here, and they say goat rather than goat. That's why it's in the chart, because I took it out of a textbook which we did in Lancaster, which is in the northwest of England. So they thought it was a particularly important point to make that some parts of England actually produce different vowel sets or rely on different vowel sets. Okay. There is a vowel down here which is to the back and to the further down, which is the so-called strut vowel. Strut, So you can see how the tongue is lowered and quite open. That's the strut sound. This is a vowel sound which does not exist in the north of England. If you've been to the north of England and you've been welcomed by, I don't know, your bed and breakfast person, you come up, love. Yeah, then this is because she cannot say come up, love, because she will say come up, love. Because the strut vowel just simply doesn't exist. So they use the foot vowel instead. Right, so far we've only introduced vowels which are produced in such a way that the tongue doesn't move. But of course we have vowels where this is not the case, where the tongue moves. We've got I, okay, goat, if you live in the south, choice, okay. And that's of course the difference between monophthongs and diphthongs, and I think that should be clear to you. Okay. I don't know. These are the diphthongs in English, in British English. Okay. So what we actually have is we have two IPA vowels, two IPA symbols, but it actually is only one vowel. Okay? And in this way we can describe all of the vowels that we produce. In fact, there is one which I haven't mentioned yet, and this is the vowel which corresponds to the graphemes, to the letters in the words about and letter. This is the lazy vowel. Okay. This is the one where everything sort of just happens. Where the tongue isn't particularly raised, where it isn't particularly low, where there isn't particularly front, not back. It's just in the middle. And that's what happens when you basically do nothing. Okay. This is called a schwa. Okay. And the schwa is this sort of E which is on top. Which is head down. Okay. This is, in fact, probably the most frequent vowel in English, because every single unstressed syllable in English, and there are many unstressed syllables, are typically produced with a schwa. All of them are. In fact, they're only found in unstressed syllables. Not every unstressed syllable is, but that's where they're found. Okay, as I said, in Finnegan you'll find a slightly different set of symbols. For example, there are different diphthongs. Okay. So instead of the I, we have the I with this sort of day symbol. Okay. He doesn't distinguish between the nurse vowel and the schwa, they are both the same. Okay. Also, of course, what you find in Finnegan, because he is using American pronunciation, you will find a lot of, you'll find the sounds of American, yes. Well, I would recommend, let's put it like that. Many of you will have the exam as your foremost consideration at the moment. I will not ask you to transcribe in the exam. But you need to be able to describe what's going on, and you need to be able to make sense of them. So, that's why for the exam itself, it doesn't really matter. Yeah? But I would recommend that you use the IPA because it's the worldwide standard. And that's why we've decided to introduce it here. Virtually everyone here in the department, there is one known exception to me, at least, only one, uses the IPA. Okay. You need to be flexible there. This is something that you will encounter again. Okay, I think you're ready for your short break. Let's try this out. I would like you to transcribe the word phonetic. And I would like you to give me a detailed description of each sound in the word phonetic. Can I give you 2.5 minutes for that? Now. The fact that you haven't got the full system in front of you, it doesn't mean you're not expected to get everything right now, but you should try. Okay, shall we continue? As I said, I realized you didn't have the IPA chart in front of you, most of you, etc. So this was really just an exercise and the moment to give you a breather as well. But I'll show you the result. Okay. Now notice that I put square brackets around it. This indicates that it is a phonetic transcription. It is a transcription which represents the sounds in the IPA. Okay. We will talk about a different transcription soon. We will talk about a phonemic transcription in a minute. Don't worry about that now. This is a phonetic transcription. You need the brackets, but you only need it once. You don't need it around each of the sounds. Okay. Let's look at each of those and talk about how they are produced. This is a voiceless labiodental fricative. Okay? This is a schwa, so a short, mid-centered, unrounded vowel. Okay. I didn't say vowel or consonant, but I think that should be obvious. The N is a voiced alveolar nasal. Then we've got a short mid-front unrounded vowel. We've got a voiceless alveolar plosive. We've got a short high-front unrounded vowel. And then we've got a voiceless velar plosive. Now, this is something that you need to be able to do. This is something, not the transcription as such, in the exam. Okay? It doesn't hurt if you can do it. But you need to be able to give a full definition or description of each sound used in English. and I can guarantee that one of the questions in the exam will be exactly that. Okay? I will give you one of the symbols of the IPA, either a vowel or a consonant, and you are supposed to describe it, and you're supposed to give me a word where it occurs, and you're supposed to underline the graphemes or the letters used to represent the sound. 20% of students then forget to underline. I'll come back to that when we prepare for the exam. And then obviously I can't count that part of the answer right. But let's face that later. Okay? So, this is something that you can learn. This is a nuisance. Yes, I agree. It's lots of new words. Okay? It's something which actually makes sense once you thought about place of articulation, manner of articulation, etc. Yes? You can then build up. You really only need to learn a few concepts and then can make up all of the sounds that you need for English. An amazingly large number of people don't answer this question. I have no idea why. So, I wanted to say this very early on. You'll be expected to do that. If you're planning to transcribe, to use the IPA yourself, I'd like to give you a few pieces of advice. First of all, don't rely on spelling. That very often doesn't work. And you should now, well, given what we talked about last time, you should see why. Okay? So, two letters don't mean two sounds. Okay? And vice versa, probably. I always find it difficult not to confuse the voiced and the voiceless z versus s, or rather here s versus z. Okay. You shouldn't forget the brackets, but you only need one. Okay, one set. Okay. And there is no punctuation. If you want to transcribe. If you want to do this using a computer, for example, when you later want to write a term paper and you need to transcribe a particular word because you're talking about different words in different varieties, for example, then I can give you some help here from my old university in Lancaster. There is a PDF which tells you on how to integrate the necessary font into your system. It says somewhere there at the bottom, at the end, contact Kevin Watson if you have problems. Don't contact him, please. In the meantime, he's actually moved to New Zealand. Yeah, so, okay. It mentions hex code somewhere there. Don't worry too much about this. If you want to know more about this, this is the link. Also, here is a very helpful link for you. Which is actually the IPA chart, but you can click on the symbols and then you can copy paste them into your document. Okay, so that's quite helpful. And now we've got the last three lines populated again and people chatting again up there. Please. Okay, there is also an interactive vocal track chart. Which I thought I'd mention because you can actually change certain options here and you can see what happens. Okay. Use this. Easy to use and then you can actually see what happens in the mouth. So, for example, if you change this from here to there, then you can see this has changed. We have now alveolar in terms of the tongue. Okay. Very easy to use this as preparation. In fact, there are many sounds in the languages of the world that we haven't covered. Okay. In fact, we've only covered it for the standard parts of British English. In fact, well, considering if you consider the northern dialect as a standard. And we've only really looked at the basics, but I thought I wouldn't really want to give you more at this stage. There are also some rather exotic sounds in English. Anyone been to Liverpool? Or heard a Liverpool football player give an interview and not understood a word? I'll play you one in a minute. Liverpool dialect is very interesting in various respects, but one of the, one could say, exotic aspects is that the final K, the syllable final K, becomes a fricative. What does it mean? Well, the K is no longer a K, but it is a K. Okay. So a Liverpool speaker will not talk of sharks, but of shafts. Well, the shaft. Okay. And the wich. Why wich and shach? So ch versus ch. Well, this has got to do with the preceding vowel. Okay. Here is Jamie Carragher. I don't know, some of you might know him. Yeah? I'll say it to you again, but notice that the last word he says is center back, which is actually center back. Yeah? And notice that he talks about becoming quicker. Quicker rather than quicker. Okay. I'll play it again. I struggle a lot understanding that myself. My former colleague Kevin Watson says, "Why? That's normal." He is from Liverpool. So, some rather exotic sounds in English here. Exotic in the sense of that or sh is not usually part of the consonantal system of English. Okay, that leaves me with 15 minutes to introduce a really fundamental difference, a really important difference. Namely, the difference between phonetics and phonology. Because, as you may have seen on the schedule, the first lecture is on phonetics, the second one is on phonology. I'm going to say, well, I'm not going to say the same thing again, but I'm going to repeat in some different ways what I say now again at the beginning of next lecture. Okay? Now, if you're again invited to produce this yourself, if you look at the words pit and spit, we've got the two words, no, sorry, the two sounds, p. Are they the same? Try it out. Is pit the same sound, is the p in pit the same as the p in spit? What's different? What's different? Yeah. Yeah, sounds more like a B. I see why you say that, but that's not. Well, a B, you mean, is more voiced? Produce spit. Spit. The voicing starts with the vowel E, but not with the consonant T. Yeah? That's basically what you've. Yeah, there's something else. No? Yes? Plosive? Well, both are plosives. There is something to do with aspiration. Okay? If you put your hand in front of your mouth while doing this, and you say pit and spit, then you can see that then you can feel that in the second word, whatever comes out of your mouth, mostly I guess air, is actually not as strong in the second case. This is because the P has less aspiration. Now, yes?
Would it be therefore an affricate?
No. No, it's not an affricate because of that. No. It's still, no. I can see why you're asking that, but no. And I'll tell you why, or I try to, or I see. Mm-hmm. Right, so if you wanted to transcribe this, we could come up with a more detailed transcription system and could say that we could have something like a little H there, because in a way, well, that makes it into something like a little affricate. I can see why you're saying that. Yes, okay. But not quite. Okay. Can you find the words where, whether you say p or p, no, I can't even do this a lot, with or without aspiration, results in two different words? Well, since I'm running out of time, I can give you the answer. No, you can't in English. Okay. Can you find a word in English, no, a set of words in English, where when you produce, whether you produce the sound d or v, you produce different meanings? Yeah, very easy. Bet versus vet, for example. Yeah. Are there any Spanish people in here? Anyone Spanish? Anyone a native speaker of Spanish? Okay, but you speak Spanish. No? Sorry? You study Spanish. Well, that's okay. That's sufficient. Is that the case in Spanish as well? Are there words in Spanish where whether you say the or the, you produce different words? Yes. Okay. The answer is no. There is no minimal pair, as it's called in Spanish, where the only distinction of the sounds that you produce is the change from a b to a v. The way to look at this is to say that in English, the aspirated p and the non-aspirated p, which I now probably also produce in an aspirated way, fulfill the same function. But it depends on where in the word they are, whether they are syllable initial, or whether they follow a sound, a sibilant, as it's sometimes called. If they follow an S sound, then they are not aspirated. Okay. In English, B and V, the B and V sound, don't fulfill the same function. I've already said that speakers of Spanish don't have the same system. So if, for example, a Spanish speaker says, I have a lot of problems with my vowels, then he or she may mean vowels, but will actually, to the speaker of English, say that he or she has lots of problems with their bowels, which are the intestines, things inside. So quite obviously something different. Okay. And that's because for a speaker of Spanish, the sounds b and v cannot create minimal pairs. So within the system of Spanish, they are not meaning distinguishing. Or, to put this differently, they are part of the same phoneme. They are part of the same thing, so to speak, but they are just produced differently depending on where they are with respect to other sounds. For example, you said at the beginning of words it's always b. Okay. Now, when we talk about the sounds themselves and when we describe those sounds, then we talk about phones. These are not the kind of telephones. These are just phones. Okay. These are language independent sounds. A b in Spanish is the same b as in English. It does something different in Spanish and English, but it's the same sound. And different phones, and their variants in fact, can be used for this. No, sorry. Different phones can be used for the same function in a particular language. So the phone as in the aspirated P, or the non-aspirated P, is in fact used for the same function in English. And that's when we talk about phonemes. This is something which is language dependent. And when we look at this, then we talk about phonology and no longer about phonetics. We could say that p and p, no, they sounded the same again, but you get the feeling, one, or get the meaning, one with an aspiration, one without. When we produce the two, they are realizations of the same phoneme in English. There may be languages, there are languages, where this distinction is meaningful in the sense that it creates minimal pairs. When we transcribe in a language-independent way, then we do phonetic transcription. We use brackets. When we do a phonemic transcription, and I'll tell you more about that next week, then we do a phonemic transcription with slashes. So, in other words, this is the phonetic transcription, and this is the phonemic transcription when we look at English. In the phonemic transcription, the distinction between the aspirated P and the non-aspirated P is not relevant, so to speak, because it's the same thing. It's not the same thing, of course. We can measure the difference. We can acoustically measure the difference. We can measure the difference by putting our hands in front of our mouth. But within the system of English, it doesn't matter which of the two it is. So, that's the final term that I wanted to introduce, and I'll mention that again next time. We could say that the aspirated P and the non-aspirated P are allophones of the same phoneme. You will later on in later lectures hear about allomorphs. Okay. So we will get back to allo things. Okay. But the important thing is that you now realize that within the system of English, this means that they perform the same function. They may be doing this in different places. I'll give you one last example, and this is a bit of a controversial example, actually. The bottle, or bottle. What we have here is two ways of pronouncing the t sound. Once as a t, and once as a glottal stop. Now, some people say that these are allophones of the phoneme t. I say only some people say that because the other people who don't say that think that allophones are really only something within one society, within one set of speakers. While the difference here between bottle and bottle doesn't rely on, well, relies on social differences usually. Okay. If you haven't understood the last bit, no worries. Next lecture. More on phonology, quite a bit more on phonology. I'd like to say a few words about syllables and their structures. And then we will look at what actually happens when we really speak. We look at connected speech. Remember, the tutorials start next week. Okay. In the tutorials, you'll be able to practice what we've just done. And you're being very polite again. There will be a lecture later on politeness. What you're doing currently isn't actually that. But anyway, I will also upload something tomorrow probably, which is an exercise that you can do in preparation for the tutorials, but also just, even if you don't go to the tutorials, to see whether you've understood what's going on here. Now you can leave.